This is the E-Commerce Edge podcast with your host, Jason Greenwood.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of the podcast. It is my absolute pleasure to welcome Kusha Karvandi from Kazaam to the pod. Welcome, Kusha.
Awesome. Thanks for having me.
My absolute pleasure. And look, before we get into what Kazaam is and does and how it came to be and how it came to what, were you scratching an itch, etc. Before we get into that, how did you get to be in the Amazon / e-commerce space? What's your background? What drew you into this space? Because everybody that I have on the podcast that's in the e-commerce space seems to have a really interesting story, background. There's no one pathway into this industry that everybody follows. For me, I fell into it. I had a friend of a friend who was running an agency almost 24 years ago and introduced me, and that's how I got into the industry. And so it's everybody's journey is different. So what does your journey look like?
Yeah, I was working in the fitness industry in the beginning of my career, in my early 20s. I did that for about 10 years. I was managing health clubs. I had 70 employees, and I was even training some clients myself as a personal trainer. I had like almost 24 certifications. And so I had a real passion for health and fitness, and I still do. And my wife and I, we've been together for almost 20 years now, met in high school. And so we always knew that we wanted to have kids and a family early on. And so I knew that working the hours I was working in the gym, which was like basically getting up at 3 a.m., being at the gym at 5 a.m., being there to probably 7 p.m., 6.5 days a week, was not really a long-term solution. And I got fortunate enough to meet a lot of interesting people, members at the gym who are e-commerce entrepreneurs. And this is probably 10, 12 years ago, maybe even 13 years ago or so. And I just was intrigued by these people who had so much freedom of time. I was so confined with trading my time for money and being basically a prison of the gym, working like crazy hours and seeing these people come in. I had a friend who was coming in 3 times a day to work out. I was like, how's this guy have the time? He's coming in so many times a day. I'm like, what is he doing? And then of course he is doing e-commerce, and he was building a rapidly growing e-commerce brand. And so I just found that really fascinating. And I knew that was something that I had to get into and learn. And so it took a while. Just, I think it was more by accident, really. What happened is I came across an article in the journal Strength and Conditioning about something called blood flow restriction training, which is a type of exercise that's very specialized. It was more being used for like physical therapy, and only products that were out there were like several $1,000 medical devices. And when I researched online, the people in the bodybuilding space were using wrist wraps and knee wraps and things like that, which are really difficult to apply by yourself and to do consistently. So I decided I wanted to launch a product, an e-commerce product, which was my first product, called BFR Bands. And it was going to be something that was a practical product that you could use in the gym for the average consumer at a reasonable price. And so we didn't know anything about e-commerce. So my wife did the research, and I think she stumbled upon Amazon FBA. And back then it was very easy. Still is pretty simple to get a product up and running, but it was the easiest place to launch a product because Amazon takes care of the traffic. The eyeballs are already there. You don't need to drive the traffic. They take care of the customer service for the most part and the communication between the customer and the returns. They take care of the fulfillment with FBA. So we thought this is going to be probably the lowest hanging fruit for us, easiest, least path of restriction to start. So we launched our first product there. And in the beginning, it was exciting to see us selling like a couple dozen units a month. Selling one or two units a day was exciting. And then over time that we started growing and growing, and it became exponential. And within a year or two, basically left that full-time job and was working on our own business. And then eventually in 2020, we ended up, during the pandemic of all times, we ended up selling that brand, sold that. And that actually was our second exit. We had another exit from a different brand that I had created slightly before that. But yeah, that was an exciting time to build that and sell that. The first exit we had was actually a product that I had seen an opportunity for in the massage gun space about 6 years ago, before Theragun, all these brands were really popular. And it just really intrigued me to see this kind of percussive massage device that you hadn't really seen at the time. And I knew it was going to be a burgeoning category. Yeah, I basically created a custom product in China and we launched it. And then within 12 months, we were doing like $1 million a month in revenue, 100% on Amazon. And then within 18 months, I sold that brand in 2019. So that was very exciting to get that very quickly up and running and launched. And that was our first exit. The Bar Bands, I mentioned, was our second exit, 2020. And then after that, I held back and excluded some of my existing brands in my Amazon seller account and such in that 2020 exit. I added some new brands to the mix and rolled up that portfolio and sold it in 2021, at the end of 2021. And then since then, I basically done the same thing where I've rolled up some new brands and launched some new stuff and did our first acquisition of a brand. And yeah, we've scaled that now to the multiple seven figures and hoping to have another good exit in the next, you know, few years.
Amazing. Okay, so you've built these Amazon brands. You wanted to get out of the rat race. You wanted to be your own boss. You and your wife wanted to be your own bosses, and you wanted to build something that was uniquely for you. And you found Amazon as a fantastic pathway to do that. What is your sense about, and many people seem to have this love-hate relationship with Amazon. They're a frenemy. They use their data against their merchants in many respects. They'll move from a 3P model to a 1P model. They will create their own white labeled products to compete with their sellers. Amazon isn't known always for doing the right thing by its sellers. They have made it very clear that what they are trying to do the right thing by is their buyers, the customers. So they don't really care who the seller is, whether it's them, whether it's a third party, whether it's a manufacturer in China, in Asia, in LATAM. They don't really care about any of that side. They don't really care too much about the supply side and what that looks like, although they're always trying to bring on new channels of supply. They are primarily concerned about the sell side. They are primarily concerned about the user experience on the customer end. And they've made that very clear. They've made no bones about that. They have tried to bring efficiency to their platform in every way possible. They've tried to improve the customer experience over time in every way possible. And I think where brands have fallen over, or where the hype train has been never more evident, is in Thrasio, right? And these Amazon FBA roll-up companies, right? Mm-hmm. And this hype train came to an unceremonious end after COVID. Thrasio famously is gone in this. There's several other roll-ups that have gone under over the last 1 to 2 years as COVID started to tail off and the online TAM collapsed versus when everybody started going back to physical retail. Amazon was doing it hard just like everybody else, but they seem to have weathered the storm as a company. It's just a lot of their sellers are beginning to struggle more. They recently made an announcement in the last 30 days that they are raising their rates on almost every single service that they provide. They're going to start charging for inbound receipting into FBA warehouses. They are going to start charging for inventory transfers between FBA warehouses. They basically have raised every single aspect of the cost structure of doing business with Amazon quite dramatically over the last 12 months. And they have signaled to the market they're going to continue to ratchet. Now that they have a virtual monopoly in what they do and how they do it, they are going to dramatically increase costs across the board for merchant sellers on their platform. So what is your sense? Do you believe that the hyper meteoric rise of Amazon over the last decade, do you believe those boom times are slowly starting to come to an end? Or do you believe that its best days are ahead of it?
No, I still think there's a lot of opportunity. I do think that it is frustrating because the fees keep going up, PPC costs keep going up, the competition keeps going up, mostly Chinese competition. The majority of new sellers coming into the platform are the Chinese sellers, and a lot of which are black cat sellers that are breaking the rules and somehow don't get in trouble. And it's frustrating to compete with sellers who aren't competing fairly, and they sabotage you and all kinds of stuff. But that being said, I feel like if you can navigate the terrain and you can be successful now, it's an advantage because a lot of other sellers will give up. In the past, it was so easy that everyone was jumping on the bandwagon. And so you didn't really have much of a barrier to entry. And now I feel like it's almost a good thing that if you could, you probably don't want to jump into Amazon as a straight beginner. You probably want to learn a little bit more. There's a little bit of prep, a little bit more prep than there used to be to really getting going on Amazon. But if you can come into Amazon with some intermediate knowledge and be somewhat successful on there, then you've overcome a large obstacle that others probably won't be able to overcome. So it does establish you a little bit more longevity on the platform. But I wouldn't, again, you don't want to build your whole business just on Amazon. You ideally want to try to diversify, build a Shopify store, especially if you want to use Amazon as a launch pad. I think it's a great way to do it. That's how I've done it in the past. And you use it as a way to test the viability of a product, get some initial product exposure, And then if it does well, then you can expand that out to a Shopify store, wholesale, retail, TikTok, ads, meta ads, whatever it may be. You can branch out your traffic and your distribution outside of Amazon, where you can then own the customer and have that data and build an email list and that sort of thing. Those are obviously a lot more complex, a lot more advanced than just getting up on Amazon and listing a product there. But I still believe in Amazon. I still think it's a great opportunity. It's still way cheaper than building a Shopify store and driving traffic to it. Unless you really have a great product that's got some good IP around it or a good moat around it, and it's already been tested and proven in some way. If you're just trying to get some idea, some concept up and running, like private label, for example, like a Shopify store would be very hard, because what people underestimate is the traffic. Getting traffic to your store profitably, it's a very difficult thing to do.
It certainly is. And so unless you have a massive personal brand and personal brand audience, then of course it makes absolute sense to own your own piece of the internet pie and be driving traffic to an owned property. That makes sense. But you're right. I spend a lot of time on Reddit and LinkedIn. And in particular on Reddit, there's 5 to 10 posts a day. My new Shopify store, I put $5,000 into ads. I haven't made a single sale. Or, hey, I spent $10,000 building my Shopify site. I've spent $2,500 in ads in the last 7 days and I haven't made a single sale. Go and roast my site. I think that there's this misunderstanding out there still, which just shocks me. As someone who's been in this industry for over 20 years, it still shocks me. It absolutely shouldn't, but it shocks me that people think they can just stand up a Shopify store, sell the same old crap, drop ship like everyone else, have absolutely no differentiation, have absolutely no moat, have no brand, have no audience, have no nothing. And I think that maybe in some respects, Shopify bears some responsibility for this, because their ads, they make it sound so easy. And it is easy to get a Shopify store up and running. But a Shopify store does not automatically mean and equate to a successful business. And I think that's what we're talking about here. We're saying, look, an owned channel, you have to know how to manage and run and then develop every single facet of an e-commerce business, right? Whereas with Amazon, they take over a tremendous amount of the responsibility for multiple aspects of an e-commerce business, where really what you are responsible for is sourcing a product that hopefully is unique, hopefully has some sort of defensible moat around it. You are responsible for organizing that either to be manufactured or getting those products from the manufacturer into Amazon's hands, managing your listings, managing your account on Amazon to stay within Amazon's rules and make sure that you are keeping anybody who buys your product happy, so that you get positive feedback and it builds a positive flywheel around your Amazon brand. And I think this is the key. You are building an Amazon brand on Amazon. You are not building an independent brand off Amazon. Sure, a lot of brands try to use Amazon as an acquisition channel, but even that seems to be somewhat difficult in many scenarios, because Amazon customers tend to be loyal to Amazon, not to the brands that sell on Amazon. I know for me personally, right? I have never bought so much stuff off of Amazon as I have since we moved to Mexico just over a year ago. And it's primarily because independent D2C e-commerce is not that big of a deal yet in Mexico. There are three primary big, massive online retailers here. It is Amazon, it is Mercado Libre, and it is Coppel. And basically, they are just hoovering up the market share of online sales in Mexico very rapidly, because they're all effectively marketplaces, and they're all aggregating supply and demand in very concentrated ways. And they have managed to overcome the challenges of distribution and logistics in a country that is known to be very challenging to set up distribution in. So I think that what's interesting about this is I trust Amazon in Mexico. I don't necessarily trust individual sellers. When I go to Amazon, I'm not going to the seller's individual brand page on Amazon. I'm not necessarily looking at just that brand's individual feedback. I'm not necessarily then Googling that brand's website to see if they sell direct to consumer. I'm not necessarily doing that. I trust Amazon to sort that out for me. My trust is in Amazon, not necessarily in individual sellers on Amazon. And from your standpoint, Is that the secret sauce more than anything else, is the fact that they have managed to build a trusted brand in Amazon, regardless of who sells on their platform?
Yeah, and they make it easy, and the free 2-day shipping, like that's a big part of it, you know, making it really trustworthy for the transaction, but also really easy for the free 2-day shipping. People love that. I mean, that was like a big part of what, you know, Amazon Prime was about. Now, not so much. Not everything's too free 2-day shipping. Some are faster. Some are same day, which is crazy. Not everything is free 2-day. But yeah, I would say the main thing I will say about that is I wouldn't underestimate the power of creatives. So even if you're launching with a private label product in the beginning, I definitely recommend at the very least trying to create some type of a brand that you can get a pending trademark for or a registered trademark for, putting your branding on that product, even if it is generic, and private label that product, put it up, and invest in some good creatives. And I'm talking about the images in the main carousel area at the top of the listing. I'm talking about the video in the main carousel area, the premium A+ imagery in the product description area. That content, you can really set yourself apart and give the consumer the perception that you're a larger brand, even though it may just be maybe you're in, you know, a company of one. A lot of these brands that I see on Amazon are most likely not large companies. They're all small companies under 10 employees, probably doing less than 7 figures in sales, but they can have the perception that they're a lot bigger than they are. They can look with the right type of branding and creatives. If it looks professional, if the brand sounds legitimate, if you can tell when it's a Chinese seller because the brand makes no sense. It looks like somebody punched a bunch of random letters on the keyboard and it doesn't make any logical sense. And also the words and the images don't make sense. They're not proper grammar. That can really hurt the perception of you being a real brand versus just being some type of foreign product. So people can see that pretty easily and sniff that out. So you definitely want to have that. You want to have as seen in badges if you can. Try to get your product in, so you can even advertise your product in certain magazines or on certain sites, or do press releases to then use those as seen in badges on your product details page. That adds a lot of credibility. But then in doing that, you can then use product inserts to then hopefully get people to maybe interact with you directly. I know Amazon obviously doesn't really want you trying to take their customer and turn into your customer, but you technically could put some kind of insert in there that has your website on it, maybe a coupon for their next order to order directly from you or something like that. You could potentially do something like that to get them into your ecosystem. And I personally have done that many times where as a consumer, I bought a product off Amazon and I see, hey, wait, this is way cheaper from their website. And I do feel like Shopify is, it's not a major threat to Amazon yet. I think that they could be a bigger threat if they built their own marketplace ecosystem rather than individual sites that people are operating. I like the checkout process. It's very similar to Amazon, where you put in your email or your phone number, it auto-populates all your information. There's a lot of trust there in that checkout process. And so when I see that, I'm like, okay, I'll just go buy from the Shopify seller directly. I'll get the same kind of free day shipping. Maybe it's not quite as fast, but I'm going to get it for way cheaper. I like this brand. I trust the brand. I like the brand story. I believe in the brand story, the founder. If you can connect with that brand on a personal level, you're going to be much more likely to buy from them directly. So I do think it's very possible and I see it happen every day.
Yeah. And I think that also from what I've seen, warranty registration and other forms of almost forced engagement directly with the brand can get those customers to be, it basically incentivizes those customers to have some sort of engagement directly with the brand. Right. And what we're talking about here. We're talking about how can we become more sticky in the customer's mind by ensuring that they have some sort of contact point or some sort of need to have a direct contact point with us as a brand. And I guess that makes a really nice segue into what you're doing with Kazam, which, as I understand it, in full transparency, I've never worked with the Kazam platform before, so I'm no expert, and I'm definitely not an Amazon expert by any stretch of the imagination. So this is your baby. This is your space. So I'm a little bit ignorant to a lot of what happens on Amazon because I've never sold on Amazon before myself. But as I understand it, you've got within the Amazon ecosystem, you've got these it's a two-pronged approach to selling on Amazon and being successful on Amazon. You've got all of the organic. It's like being on Google, right? You can do all of your SEO and you can do all of your organic work on Google to boost your listings and get the long tail. then you can pay for Google Ads, and it takes an almost individual expertise to be able to run really effective Google Ads, really profitable Google Ads, and optimize those for the query volume that's out there in the market. And then it's a totally different specialization and skill set to be able to do SEO at scale that is going to allow you to do well on Google organically. And it feels like we've got the same thing happening on Amazon. You've got specialists that know how to optimize listings really well for organic rankings within Amazon. They know how to boost up the presence of your individual seller account in Amazon. They know all the tricks of the trade to make sure that you maintain a really high seller ranking, that you basically perform well organically on Amazon. And then we've got this whole other thing, which is the new ad, not new now, it's the third biggest ad platform in the United States after Google and Meta, is Amazon. And so Amazon now has a paid ad platform that's a whole new area of specialization. So all the people that were really good at doing organically on Amazon, they don't necessarily know how to do really good Amazon ads that perform well and drive a significant amount of business efficiently for the brand. And this is where it's that second piece. It's the paid advertising on Amazon where Kazam comes into the picture, right?
Yep. Yeah, exactly. Kazam was something I created because of the fact that PPC just keeps getting more expensive. Like you mentioned, Amazon's charging more and more fees to third-party sellers. So I wanted something that was going to get more profitable for the seller over time. And as far as I had seen, there's no advertising software out there that took into account your organic ranking position on Amazon when it came to your bids and your ad costs. And so with Kazam, what we did is an AI-based tool that utilizes both all of my knowledge and an algorithm that takes all my everything that I was doing manually to run my ads and our clients' ads through our agency, and basically tries to compile all that into a process to make things more profitable as you scale. So if I have a product that's maybe, let's say it's brand new, or maybe it's just not ranking well for my target keywords, as that product starts to rank at the top of the page for those target keywords, the system is going to recognize that and track that, and it's going to adjust your bids accordingly to reduce your cost. Because in most cases, it doesn't make sense to have this redundant cost, this redundancy of having you show up in the sponsored section as well as the organic section if you're already showing up there. I don't really, in most cases, I don't find that it really helps your conversion that much as a brand to have both. It's way more profitable to have just the organic by itself. And of course, if you lose your rankings, the system will kick that back on and, you know, bring the bids back up. The goal is to, as long as you're sustaining your rankings, to keep those bids as low as possible so you're not overspending and minimizing those redundancies for at least for search. As we mentioned, the Amazon algorithm is changing, and PPC is becoming a more important part of maintaining rankings. In the past, you could just focus on driving some of your own traffic, getting some initial sales, maybe some initial PPC, and then you could really just turn it off and then you'd, you know, be able to sustain it. But now it's gotten so competitive in most categories, at least, where, especially if you have competition who's running a lot of PPC, if you're not running PPC, then you'll probably lose rankings over time, most likely, unless you have a really well-differentiated product that sells way more units than everybody else. Historically, what I've seen is you'll slowly start to lose rankings if you don't have some PPC going in the background at all times.
So this is effectively your platform helps brands do what many performance marketing agencies have been doing for years on Google, which is to say, okay, you're a brand new brand, you haven't really been indexed yet, or you don't really have the long tail happening in Google yet. It's a slow burn. The SEO optimization of a website, Shopify or whatever platform, it's a slow burn. It takes time to get ranked. It takes time to build up content. It takes time to really have a brand presence organically in Google, right? And so what a lot of agencies will do is they'll say, look, we as a performance marketing agency, we'll fill those gaps. We'll fill the bucket really quickly with paid traffic. And then especially for branded traffic in particular, once that SEO starts to kick in and as the branded traffic starts to rise, we'll start to scale back our branded search ads. And sometimes even for specific products that have really good SEO representation, maybe we won't go as hard on the Google ads for those products because they're ranking so well and they're converting so well organically. We now can reallocate some of that spend to other products that maybe either aren't ranking well or aren't converting well organically. We're now going to reallocate that budget. That's where ad strategy, I think, within Google comes in, is how and when do we allocate our performance budget versus our SEO rankings and SEO budgets and SEO efforts. that they have to play in a balance, right? And so I think what you're saying is effectively we have to do the exact same thing. We have to use the exact same tactics and strategy on Amazon as we would in Google with SEO versus performance, right?
Yep, exactly. That's exactly correct. That's really what it's become with the game of Amazon.
And from a pricing perspective, again, I'm not the expert. From a CPM perspective, how does Amazon PPC or performance, how does it compare to Google and Meta from a cost-based perspective?
Yeah, I would say what you're paying Amazon is the 15% referral fee, you know, when you get that customer. When we talk about PPC, they use a metric called ACOS, your advertising cost of sales, which is the invert of ROAS. So if you have a 2x ROAS, that would be like a 50% ACOS. So really it depends on the category, the competition, and your margins. But from what I've seen is the two metrics we'll look at is your ACOS, and also we'll look at your total ACOS, which is your total account sales, not just the ones attributed from advertising, because you do get a lift in organic ranking like we talked about. For every sale you get through PPC, through keywords, Amazon's algorithm is taking that into an account and it's giving you a lift in rankings organically for those keywords. So we look at both. And yeah, what I found is like in the beginning, you might be like 30 to 50% ACOS, maybe higher if you don't have a super competitive product or it's a super competitive niche. But then over time, you can drive that thing down, the ACOS down to maybe 10 to 20%, which would be like a 5 to 10x ROAS. And that's really hard to achieve outside of Amazon. Like 5 to 10x ROAS on Meta is impossible.
Yeah, it makes sense. Yeah, totally. And do you find that new brands on Amazon, new sellers on Amazon, it's like Google nowadays that effectively you have to, if you want to have a chance at performing well on Amazon, if you want to have a chance of building a brand and building a moat, building up traffic to your listings and building up your seller ranking, et cetera, that pretty much you have no choice now but to do performance on Amazon like you do in the Google world. Because nobody nowadays would set up a brand new Shopify store, for example, without running Google ads, at least at first. It just would never happen. And it's, you wouldn't set up your own Shopify store and not run Meta ads. I think almost everybody is going to do some form of performance marketing when they first set up their website until the SEO element starts to kick in and starts to drive some free traffic. It's never free because, of course, SEO efforts have a cost associated with them. But it's probably, from an organic ranking perspective, it's probably a little bit more sustainable than to go and just pouring money into ads. But do you find that this exact same mindset or this exact same strategy is really starting to become not only the norm on Amazon, but absolutely required if you want to build a brand, a successful brand on Amazon?
Yeah, absolutely. And the beauty is with a new product on Amazon is Amazon does favor new products a little bit, where you can get new release bestseller badges, where it'll say like number one new release. And also the first like 60 days or so is like a honeymoon period, where if you get some strong sales out of the gates in the first couple months through PPC and other efforts, like if you drive Meta ads or whatever it may be, maybe direct to Amazon or TikTok ads direct to Amazon, to help drive that traffic in those search queries, Amazon will give you a big lift in rankings very quickly for those new products in those first 60 days. So it's to your advantage to try to have a plan of how you're going to drive traffic in the beginning, that rather than just like turning the listing on, sending inventory, and then figuring it out later.
So what Amazon is effectively saying is don't just rely on us to drive a whole bunch of business and free traffic for you. No, this is a synergistic relationship and you've got to invest. It's an investment from both sides. We've provided the platform, we've provided the eyeballs and the traffic, but man, you've really got to make an investment of your own. And are you finding it also going the other direction? Meaning that, I don't even know the answer to this question. Does Amazon allow you to run an ad, but not link to an Amazon product? Meaning, okay, I'm running an ad on Amazon, but the goal of this ad is to drive traffic to, say, my Shopify store. So it links out to my Shopify store instead of maybe to my product listing on Amazon. Do they even allow you to do that, or can you only advertise for listings on Amazon? Hey team, have a big favor to ask you. Please pause this episode and send the link of this episode to someone you know that you think would enjoy this content. Really appreciate you spreading the word. This is how we grow. We're not a Joe Rogan. We don't have big, massive advertising budgets, but we absolutely want to grow. We want to get the learnings from all of these episodes out to as wide of an audience as possible, and we need your help to do it. Thank you, and now back to your listening.
It's really meant for listings on Amazon, unless you, I think they do offer now like sponsored TV, so you can run some stuff on there like Amazon Prime, the video ads. Also on their demand side platform, DSP, That, I believe, you can run anywhere. You can direct them to your own website, that sort of thing. But all of the stuff inside Amazon's advertising dashboard, like sponsored products, sponsored brands, sponsored display, they all have to be linked to an Amazon listing.
Wow. Okay. So they're really... Okay, so they're really trying to keep this as part of the internal ecosystem and build up that positive flywheel of demand within Amazon, not driving traffic and not just capturing a bit of ad spend and then driving traffic off Amazon. They're trying to drive traffic to Amazon, which makes complete sense. And what does, apart from trying to take this data of organic performance versus paid performance on Amazon, and of course, Kazam compares those two, looks at that, makes sure and adjusts ad spend appropriately and budgeting appropriately. What else, what other insights and what other tooling does it provide for Amazon sellers to help them be better and do better on Amazon?
Yeah, the Amazon advertising dashboard does provide good insights, and they have brand analytics as well inside Seller Central. It provides a lot of insights about your demographics and insights around the conversion around your product and the click share around your product for certain keywords. But the main thing that's really important for most sellers that's overlooked is just focusing on relevancy. You got to make sure your product is really relevant, having your main keywords really baked into the title and the first bullet point. And if it's not relevant for certain keywords, you're going to pay a higher cost. Amazon's algorithm for PPC really takes into account relevance. So you're more likely to get clicks and a lower bid cost if you're most relevant. Because again, Amazon wants to sell product. I think their priorities is to sell product first and then sell advertising second. If they're sure that, hey, this seller A and seller B, and seller A is for sure going to sell at a higher conversion rate, and we're going to make more profit off that third-party seller through sales versus seller B, who's maybe bidding a little higher but not as relevant, we don't know if they're even going to get a click or a sale, they're going to advertise seller A. So that's where you ought to really make sure, number one, you got to have a good product. You can't skip that step. You can't just throw something up there. You got to make sure to do your homework, try to find a way to differentiate at least a little bit, maybe make a small, slight improvement without having to spend a fortune in molds and tooling costs, that sort of thing. Just some kind of small differentiator, at least in the beginning, to test the idea. Or at a very minimum, like I said, just sell a private label product without any major changes. But at a very minimum, try to put your brand on it, maybe add some bonuses to it, maybe a multi-pack, something to differentiate that way without having to spend a fortune on the molds and tooling customization yet. But you got to have a good product. There's no way around that in the beginning.
I'll just use this little product that I'm holding in my hand right here, which is a set of True wireless headphones. And I had never even heard of this brand before. It's a Chinese brand. It's DCY. And I remember, so I just recently bought these off Amazon, and they're amazing. They're a really good product. And I did a lot of homework, actually, on earbuds before I made my purchase. But what's interesting I found, and what I can get you to validate my thinking on this, I remember I looked on Amazon for True Wireless earbuds maybe 1 or 2 years ago. I think it was about 2 years ago. And there was so much shit on Amazon. Like the quality of the cheapest products, they were just no name, absolute crap products. Of course, you were also able to see the Beats, and you were also able to see the name brand products, of course, as well. But at the bottom end of the pricing tier, there was just complete and utter rubbish that had really bad feedback. Yeah, they were cheap. They were $20 or whatever it is, but they got really bad feedback. They were just cheap and nasty products. Now, this time around, when I went to start searching for True wireless earbuds, there was none of that. There was the odd cheap brand, but I noticed that it seems that Amazon is starting to the purge, as I like to call it, of absolute bottom of the barrel, complete and utter trash products, generic ripoffs, generic knockoff products. It feels like they're taking a much, much harder line on that. And so even though this product is not a massively well-known name brand, once I started researching on the product comparison websites, this brand actually came up as being a top performer for the money. And this product was in the bottom pricing tier. This was a very popular product that showed up in all my searches. When I put in the price filter band, it showed up right near the top. So it seems to me, based on my, and like I said, because we've recently moved to Mexico and we're trying to kit out our kitchen and our house and everything, I'm buying everything through Amazon at the moment and spending an ungodly amount of money on Amazon. But just my recent experience seems to indicate that they are taking a very hard line on the absolute bottom of the barrel trash on the website and they're trying to get it out.
Yeah, or at a very minimum, they're pushing them down in the search results so you can't really even find them. Where they're using AI as well as part of their algorithm to help, again, find more relevant products to use. So your search results might be different than somebody else's based on your preferences, your location and IP and all that. I definitely think that they're making some progress there, especially with regard to intellectual property and maybe almost too much so, like where they'll take listings down first, not even for infringement, but for suspected infringement. If they think that you have a word in your listing that might be infringing on someone else's trademark, even though it's not, they'll take the listing down temporarily until you appeal it, fix it, whatever it may be. They have been using a lot of machine learning to do things like that, to clean things up, to try to take down the copycats and things like that. So that has gotten a little bit better. But even just the transparency around these junk products has gotten better, where now they even list information like if the product is highly returned. They'll say this item is a highly returned item. They'll list that on the listing. So you as a consumer, you're like, oh, I don't want to waste my time. This product's returned highly. Or it'll say the opposite, like this product is very infrequently returned or something like that. So they're becoming more and more transparent. I think that's where things are headed, because that is a big problem. I think Amazon recognizes it. I don't think they know exactly how to combat it yet, but it is a big problem where they know there's all these Chinese sellers and even US sellers and other international sellers that are selling a lot of junk. They're selling so much generic stuff on there that's just junk and highly returned and no quality control, sometimes with false claims and overtly misleading claims and things. And so they're having, I think, a hard time overcoming that and clearing those things out, because they have to have a reason to take those listings down. But I think that's what over time, what they'll do to weed those out is they'll just add more transparency around, like, hey, this product has a lot of issues. You can already see it in the reviews too. They use a little bit of AI and things to show, to aggregate like common complaints or, you know, common features and things that people liked by extracting certain phrases from those top reviews.
Yeah, no, it makes complete sense, because it reflects poorly on their brand. It reflects poorly on the Amazon brand if half the listings are just absolute utter trash products that, you know, almost disposable products that you use them one or two times and then they fail. And you don't even want to go through the hassle, because it was such a cheap product. You don't even want to go to the hassle of returning the product. So you throw it in the rubbish, but it sours your thoughts on Amazon. And Amazon must be aware of that, that some of these trash products are so cheap that people just don't even bother returning them. So you're not necessarily going to see enough return data in all instances to know that a product is trash, especially if it's a really cheap product. And yeah, I guess it's the reviews that then in that scenario. So I might not go to the hassle of returning a product that's absolute rubbish because it was so cheap, but I'll definitely leave a bad review. I'll definitely jump back on Amazon and say, oh, this failed after 1 week of use. I'm not even going to bother returning it, but I threw it in the rubbish after 1 week. Those are the kind of reviews that they can take action on.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, what happens is it goes under your negative customer experience rate in this dashboard called Voice of the Customer in Seller Central. And if you get a lot of these types of complaints, like if someone says, hey, this product doesn't work, it's defective, things like that. If you get too many of those, they might take the listing down. You might have to appeal it.
Okay, makes a lot of sense. I see that as a good thing. I don't like the fact that you're effectively saying Amazon now shoots first and asks questions later in some instances. That also sucks, right? Now, do they take into account your length of time on the platform, your previous feedback, your previous successful products, your rate of sales? Do they take that? Does it seem like, obviously we don't know what their algorithm is in terms of takedowns, but if you're a 5-year successful Amazon seller and you have a really high seller rating and you don't have a track record of stealing imagery and stealing descriptions and being fraudulent, basically, if you have a really good track record, does it seem like it happens less that someone will have a product taken down in that scenario versus someone who's brand new to the platform? Or is there no rhyme or reason to this?
I would say from a product standpoint, no, but from a seller account standpoint, yes. The risk of your seller account having issues is much lower. But your individual products, Amazon, again, the problem is they're using the majority of the time, they're it's not a human, it's like a bot that's scanning and crawling the listings. And if you have a certain word in there, like if you sell something that says antimicrobial in it, they're going to get flagged as a pesticide. And they're going to say, oh, we need your EPA regulation number. And you're going to say, well, I'm not selling pesticides. So that is, again, going back to what we mentioned earlier, this is where this can be your greatest advantage. If you can learn to navigate the terrain and overcome these appeals and learn how to learn the ropes with Amazon, how to overcome those. That's a huge advantage because most sellers will give up. Most of the sellers I've talked to are like, oh yeah, I'm just stuck. I can't get anywhere. I just talked to someone today who was like, yeah, I got listing taken down for saying it's a pesticide. It's been down for a long time. And I said, have you tried just removing whatever words are in the listing that's getting flagged? They had no idea. They didn't know that was the reason. We help a lot of clients on the agency side. We can help navigate that terrain for a lot of clients, but that is something that's really important is just got to learn one way or the other. You got to learn how to overcome those listing issues because you're going to encounter it no matter what. At some point or the other, you're going to encounter it because you just made a mistake and you put something in your listing that you didn't know was made the product, let's say a restricted product. If you're selling supplements and you make certain, even if you're selling, for example, let's say the most innocuous supplement like vitamin B, they might vitamin B6 or something. They might flag you because if you're making like weight loss claims, if you make any kind of weight loss claims, they might flag you and say, hey, we need a certificate of analysis that not only shows that the ingredients that are in there are actually in there, but also shows there's no heavy metals, also shows that you don't have these other illegal compounds, these weight loss compounds in there as well. And so that can be hard for people to navigate because then they go to their supplier. Supplier's like, oh yeah, we don't provide that. I don't have that for you. And you're like, oh my God, like now my listing's down permanently until I fix this. But there's ways around that too that are actually very simple. So yeah, they will take those down for those reasons. And then the other aspect they'll take it down is sabotage. So you'll get Chinese competitors who will basically have, my belief is they have some kind of inside employee they bribed that will go and somehow insert malicious content in your listing. So they'll go and sabotage you like crazy and they'll put malicious content, all these different fields in your listing. And then it becomes a nightmare because it gets taken down. You're trying to like quickly figure out like, how did this get there? You're trying to explain to Amazon, you didn't put it there, but Amazon is like, sorry, we're not putting your listing up till you remove it. And sometimes what they'll do is they'll get really tricky. It's really sneaky and they'll put the malicious content in another marketplace. So if you sell in Amazon US, but you've never created your listing in Amazon like UK or something like that, they'll go and do it in one of those other countries. They'll hijack your listing basically there and they'll make a contribution there. And it becomes a nightmare to basically backtrack and undo because then that contribution in that other country is now superseding your contributions in the US marketplace, but it's affecting your US listing. So it's all kinds of crazy black hat sabotage that happens there. But again, it can all be overcome. Some of these things take longer than others to overcome. Some can be in a matter of days. Some might take a few weeks to get it back up. But again, it can become a huge advantage. It can be a blessing in some ways because again, most sellers will give up. So if you can navigate it, if you can be patient, and if you're willing to ride the roller coaster, you can be successful with it in the long term.
And are there erroneous complaints, like anonymous complaints, also through the normal complaint channels at Amazon? Do they maybe have an entire either bot farm, or do they have maybe a whole room full of people that are making erroneous complaints against? Maybe there's a whole room of 1,000 people in one of these Chinese factories in China that's making erroneous complaints about their competitors to Amazon that Amazon is obliged to follow up on. And if they're taking a shoot first, ask questions later approach, then maybe they'll pull that listing down, even if it comes through the normal complaint channel through live chat or email or whatever it is. You know, maybe they don't have to sabotage your listing as such, but just they can overwhelm Amazon with complaints about you erroneously, but then they have to legitimately follow up on that, right?
Yeah, competitor complaints, they're a little more cautious about because they know that competitors will just try to complain about other competitors. So they're a little more cautious about that. If it's intellectual property complaints, they do take it more seriously and they will oftentimes, if they do think you're infringing, they might take that seller down or that listing down. I had that happen once where someone tried to say that we were infringing and then we basically appealed it and showed side-by-side images showing we're not infringing in any way on that product. And Amazon put that listing back up and we never got any response from that seller who tried to file that takedown. They just completely ghosted us. So it's not uncommon for people to play games like that. It doesn't happen that often because you know anyone who does that, it's at legal risk. If someone files a takedown, especially any kind of intellectual property takedown, Amazon actually will tell you as a seller who filed it. They'll reveal the identity of the person who filed it. So they're not anonymous. Yeah, when you go in and do that, it puts them at legal risk. So if they're going in there and in bad faith filing malicious fake claims of infringement, you could sue them and you can sue them for business interference and trying to damage the health of your seller account, your listing and all those sorts of things. I don't think Chinese sellers don't really care because they're like, oh, whatever, you can't go after me anyway. They think they're untouchable, but other sellers, US sellers and other marketplaces probably are a little more cautious about doing that for that reason. But yeah, intellectual property, they're a little bit more cautious about, but the other stuff, I would say it's more about buyer complaints than anything. If a buyer says something, they might, oh, you know what, this buyer complained, they said that they used your product and it almost burned their house down. they might take your listing down and force you to provide like a safety data sheet or something, or some type of technical certification of some sort to prove that it's safe.
Yeah, makes complete sense. And so your platform is primarily all about both budget and bid management for PPC ads on Amazon. That's really what your focus is, right?
Yep, it's all 100% Amazon. It's focused on Amazon ads. And it basically right now it focuses on sponsored products. In the future, we'll be launching some things to help people launch sponsored brands and sponsored display much easier and manage that. But it's sponsored products. And the beauty of it's designed for the beginner intermediate seller who wants to just get up and running, almost have a set it and forget it approach. Obviously, we don't recommend anyone just not oversee.
Sorry, sorry to interrupt. The fuzz is back. Something is being bumped. There's a plug or there's something that is come loose. That's fine. It's just that there's something somewhere, maybe in a plug or in a wire or something that, yeah, it's just, it goes fuzzy, almost like you're bumping the microphone or scraping the microphone. So anyways, back to it. So you were saying that basically your platform is designed for the beginner and intermediate seller. You don't have to be an Amazon expert to be able to get value out of the platform.
Yeah, it's designed for you to really get up and running in just a few clicks. Like when you go into the platform, literally all you have to do is you click this quick launch dashboard. And through the quick launch dashboard, you can just literally select what SKUs you want to advertise. And it only asks you really just a couple key points of information, like what's your target ACOS or ROAS that you want to maintain? And then what's like your, it asks you to set some guardrails for bids, like minimum, maximum bids, so it doesn't go crazy. And that's it. That's all you're required to do to enable your ads. And then once you click go, it basically is going to launch the ads for that SKU. And it's going to launch a series of campaigns incrementally over time. So it's going to launch some kind of research campaigns, and then it'll take those research campaigns and mine for certain keywords to launch other manual campaigns. And then the beauty of it is that you can basically, like I said, you can set it and forget it. You can sit back, let the system do all the heavy lifting, monitor it. But you can also get granular. So if someone's more of an expert, more advanced in Amazon, and they're like, you know what, I want to get in there and set some more advanced parameters, you can do that as well. You can go in there, you can say what your brand is, you can put your brand name, and it'll create campaigns around your brand name, both defensive and offensive types of campaigns. You can put certain keywords that you want to go after if you want to help prime our system to focus on certain keywords. Same with certain ASINs, which is like certain listings, product listings. You can put certain competitor listings that you want to focus on and target and go after. You can even do other things like day parting. Like you can say, oh, you know what? I want to make sure that I only run ads or focus on ads Monday through Friday and not on the weekend, or vice versa, or seasonality. I really want to ramp bids up or ramp them down during these seasons. So it gives you a lot of flexibility in terms of that for an advanced seller.
Yeah, and I see from a pricing model perspective, you've got that SaaS model where you've got these tiers and then you've got certain inclusions at each tier. You've got the startup at $197 a month for up to $10,000 in ad spend. So it's all based on a percentage of ad spend. Obviously, at the startup phase, it's roughly 2% of ad spend. Then it drops to, at the scale up, which is $400 a month, $397 a month, up to $50,000 in ad spend. That's roughly slightly less than 1% of ad spend. And then professional at $547 a month for up to $200,000 in monthly ad spend. So it's basically skin in the game. It's a percentage of ad spend and it's tiered.
Yep, exactly. Yeah, it's not really a percentage of ad spend right now. If they go over $200,000 a month, you'd have to have a more of a custom plan. Most sellers aren't spending that much on Amazon. But I would say the majority of, especially beginner intermediate sellers, are going to be in that initial plan for $200 a month. And to have a platform that can, in my experience, run almost as good as a really qualified media buyer, you're not really going to find any media buyer to run your Amazon ads for $200 a month.
Yeah. Yeah.
And even a lot of the other softwares that have explored that are claimed to be AI based and whatever, they're anywhere between $1,500 to $4,000 a month or more. And that's just software. There's no human running it. That's just a software running it. They're very expensive for these softwares, and some better than others. But our software is designed for somebody who can want something that's affordable and something that's also going to make their business more profitable over time.
Democratizing access to software that is allowing these businesses to scale, basically.
Yep, exactly. Exactly.
And what's on your roadmap over the next, say, 12, 18 months for the platform? What do you want to add to it? What are your customers asking for in terms of additional functionality? Or so what's already on your priority roadmap?
Yeah, we launched it. I have a long laundry list of features that I outlined before I even launched the software. But I wanted to start with just the quick launch because I knew that in the beginning, I want to keep it like simple, easy. I want to cater to the person who wants to just get something up and running and with just a few clicks without having it be super complicated and cumbersome. So in the near future, we'll probably be launching some new features, but I want to first validate that with customer feedback. And so we haven't gotten a ton of feedback yet of new features requested, But the beauty is that we're really focusing on being very nimble with our development team, that we want to reiterate features quickly. So if we start seeing that we're getting several requests of a certain feature, our goal is to launch, that would be like the next thing we'll launch. We'll launch that next feature to make that side of the advertising better. One thing I do really want to integrate is integrating either OpenAI or something like that into a tab in the dashboard where you can have a conversation with the AI. And you can, at a very minimum, interact with it like almost like a media buyer. You can say, hey, can you tell me at a high level, like, how are these campaigns performing? Give me a high level synopsis of how things have been running so far in the last 7, 14, 30 days, whatever. And potentially maybe even have it execute certain commands. Although OpenAI hasn't been extremely reliable in my experience to do that yet. So I'm a little hesitant to integrate that feature. But if we can do that reliably, that would be a cool feature to be able to just talk to it like you're talking to a human and say, tell me what you recommend. And then can you execute that for me? Or maybe you want to just tell it to, you know what you want it to do. And you say, hey, can you do me a favor? Can you go into, for this SKU, can you go adjust all the campaigns for this SKU and go and do X, Y, and Z to the bids?
Man, amazing stuff. Amazing stuff. Yeah. AI is particularly good in those types of situations where it's like more like a Q&A as opposed to, well, unfortunately, AI is not quite to the full conversational level yet where it's going to ask you questions and it's going to give you guidance almost like a BA would. It's very much more like a prompt, a question and answer, more almost like a Google query. But I think within the next 6 to 12 months, it's probably going to change pretty rapidly. It's changing every single day, actually. That's very exciting. And how should people try to get a hold of you? You've got a very sparse LinkedIn profile, so I won't point people there, but it's gokazam.com. I'll put that link in the show notes. Other than that, how do you like people to get, if they want to have a chat to you about Kazam, before they have a conversation with you before they buy, you know, or if they want to learn more, what's the best way to do that?
Yeah, we do have on the Kazam website, we do have a chat on there. And even if it's not live, we'll get a message. We'll respond in 24 hours. They can email me at info@gokazam.com as well. That's K-A-Z-A-M. info@gokazam. They can email us there. I also have a website, personal brand, meetkusha.com. That's another place that I have contact information there. They can reach me. I also have courses for Amazon sellers if they want to learn how to build a private label brand or how to build custom products with engineers and that sort of thing. But yeah, I would say those would probably be the main two sources if they want to reach out. And any way that we can support, if somebody's, hey, you know what, like I really need help with my advertising, I have some questions, reach out to me through the GoKazam path. If they need some more support, like, hey, I need to build custom products, can you help me with, because we have a team of engineers who are agency launch titans. We can help them basically full service, whether it be building the CAD models and sourcing the molds and tooling for their custom idea, and helping them navigate the intellectual property and utility patents and all that for their products. We can do that at Launch Titans. We can help them build certain funnels if they want to have like custom funnels, if they want to put an insert in their products and lead that customer through a certain pathway and have it be all custom. We can build that for them very easily. If they want to even just focus on just a more holistic approach, maybe they're not like focused just on Amazon, they have a great Shopify business too. Our team can also help with creating funnels and advertising and creatives and everything, you name it, for their direct response as well.
Wow. What a comprehensive service. And your knowledge is obviously very complete. So you've been doing this for a long time. It's not your first rodeo with Amazon. It's been born out of hard-won experience. So Kusha, I really have enjoyed our conversation together. As we come down to the end of our time together, now this is where I get to flip the script. I get to hand the microphone over to you. I get to let you ask me one question. Any question you like, can be personal or professional. So Kusha from GoKazam, what is your question for me today?
Yeah, I would say my question for you is, where do you see e-commerce and what do you think that the landscape's going to look like in 5 or 10 years?
Look, I think there's probably two major trends that I'm seeing and I'm trying to really take advantage of as best I can and help merchants take advantage of. I think it's the explosion of B2B e-commerce. I have really honed down on over the last 3 to 5 years. I've really absolutely doubled down on that new emerging channel of B2B e-commerce. And I think that most B2B brands still either don't do e-commerce at all or they do it very badly. I see B2B e-commerce being where B2C was a decade ago. And so it's still really immature, but the technology is now better than ever before to be able to service B2B merchants and be able to give a fantastic experience to their customers and be able to have all the price lists and CPQ, et cetera. So I think that's a trend that is not just a fad. It's an absolute trend. And most B2B brands are playing catch up today from a digital channel perspective. They have historically not done digital very well at all, and they haven't needed to. They oftentimes have had monopolies in their space, and they're like maybe a sole distributor or they're a sole manufacturer of their product, and so therefore they control their entire market. That's changing very, very rapidly with digital native B2B brands. There's new levels of competition coming to that space like never before. And then obviously during COVID, it put a rocket under the B2B space because they couldn't, salespeople couldn't go out and see customers. So they realized, geez, we need to have these digital routes to market. So that's a big trend. I think there's two other trends. I know I originally said two, but there's probably two more trends on top of that. Commerce everywhere, literally every single device, screen, everything we walk past, everything being commerce enabled, and then stealth commerce alongside that. I coined that term a few years ago, that term stealth commerce, where transactions are going to happen in our daily life without us even realizing their transactions. We're going to pre-authorize AI agents to be doing a lot of things on our behalf, and we're going to just have our credit card loaded into them, and then they're going to be doing purchases on our behalf. They're going to be making bookings on our behalf. They're going to be doing lots of stuff on our behalf, and they're going to be doing our bidding, and those transactions are just going to happen without us consciously thinking about them. Example would be, okay, my car ECU knows, okay, I'm now at a point where I need an oil change, an oil and filter change. The AI agent is going to go and it's going to order the oil and filter from your favorite auto parts store. It's going to have those automatically sent to your favorite predefined mechanic. It's going to automatically connect to your Google calendar. It's going to connect to the mechanic's calendar. It's going to book everything in on both sides. And then eventually when we've got full self-driving cars, it's probably going to drive itself to your mechanic as well and have the oil and filter changed and drive itself home again. So these types of transactions where we have predefined parameters where all these transactions are just going to happen to make our life easier. I think that's another major trend. And then the final one is just the continued explosion of marketplaces, niche marketplaces. We're already starting to see the growth of niche marketplaces, but particularly in the B2B sector. DC360 is predicting that by the end of this year, I think that there'll be more than 1,000 global B2B specific marketplaces active. And I only see that number continuing to grow because there's a gap. There's a void in that space today. There's not as much of a void in the B2C, D2C marketplace space, but in the B2B space, there is. And so I see that continuing to explode. So those are the trends that I'm keeping my eye on anyway.
Yeah, I believe it. Yeah, I think the machine customers is going to be a big one. People like e-commerce businesses and companies are going to be learning how to sell the machines.
Yes.
The individual customer.
Yeah, and those machines are just doing the bidding of the individual customer.
Yep, exactly. Yeah, acting as like a proxy or an agent for the customer.
Absolutely. Kusha, this has been a fantastic conversation. I've seriously enjoyed it, and I can't wait to do it again soon. Are you a B2B or D2C e-commerce merchant? Then head over to greenwoodconsulting.net to learn how we can help you scale your business.